right. So I didn't put any background slides, but I'm originally from Iowa, in north central Iowa. And in that area, all you see is pigs. If you can walk, drive a few miles and you see more pigs. And so I grew up working at pig farms, and I went to Iowa State and did an undergraduate in animal science. And all throughout there, I also worked in pigs. And then there was that one point in time where I worked for, it'd be the Iowa State University Swine Testing Station, is with, where they get progeny from all sorts of smaller pig genetics. And what we were looking at was where there was this one group of pigs where their back fat was literally bigger than their loin eye. And that kind of opened me up. I was like, whoa, what are these people doing here? back fat was kind of more along a few centuries ago where that's what pigs are for, right? And so that kind of got me started on the genetics aspect of it, and I was looking around. And looked at different universities, and I went to the University of Nebraska, and I worked under Dr. Spangler in beef cattle genetics. So when I was here for the first two, my first 2 years, I actually was at this conference, and it was a really cool conference because I like the idea of producers and genetics all in the same room. Because in reality, where I work at in Smithfield, it's like that every day, but on a smaller session, where you get feedback from producers, and as a genetic company, you can make those changes. And so I started with Smithfield in July, so I'm kind of just dangerous enough to know exactly what Smithfield is. So hopefully it won't be too horrible, so we will see. All right. So the title is The Use of Big Data in a Modern Swine Breeding Program, and Now and in the Future. And there's quotations around big data because it's kind of, whatever you think is big data is big data. And so, for example, when I was in my master's, I had just a regular computer, and I opened up genotype files for 200 animals, and my computer blew up. And I'm like, holy smokes, this is huge. And right, if you look at it now, there's millions of genotypes. So it's all relative, and that's why you'll see quotations around a lot of this big data issue. And so just kind of an outline of where we're going. And so first I'll talk about where does SPG, and that's Smithfield Premium Genetics. I'll just say it as SPG. So where does SPG fit within Smithfield? How SPG capitalized on Smithfield being integrated? And then I'll go through the historical use of big data and some of the recent big data developments, and then kind of my own opinion of, in the future, where is big data going to take us for in a swine breeding program? And so Smithfield is based out of, its headquarters are in Smithfield, Virginia, and it operates in 5 countries with more than 54,000 employees. And what you probably most know Smithfield for would probably most likely be for their processing. So they're the world's largest pork processor and the top packaged meat company. And then there is this hog production aspect of it too. And there's feed mills that are owned by it, so it goes all the way from feeding the animal all the way to the carcass. And so it's kind of just within the U.S. Smithfield is the number one hog producer, where it's roughly 15% of the commercial hogs are Smithfield, and it's the number one pork processor. It's roughly 26%. So when you go to the grocery store and you buy a package of pork, it's like a 1 in 4 chance that you're going to eat Smithfield pork. And then the number one packaged meat company, right at 19%. And so so when I first started here, I was like, Smithfield is Smithfield, right? It's not exactly. These would be the three major brands that are sold all across the U.S., but then there's regional brands down here that are also Smithfield. And so kind of just within the U.S., we have operations all the way from the West Coast all the way to the East Coast. And there's roughly, so it operates in 26 states. There's roughly 533 company-owned farms, a little over 2,000 contract farms, and then 13 leased farms. And so what's really nice about having this whole integrated system is you can really start to look at sustainability and trying to reduce your carbon footprint in terms of the animal care, the environment, the food safety and quality, and the helping communities. And I'll touch a little bit on the food safety and quality later. And then, most importantly, the people, and all this creates value. And recently, you may have heard that Smithfield launches Smithfield Renewables, and this is where they are trying to in the lagoons, they're putting a cover over them, and then they'll capture that and turn it into natural gas. And so you'll start to see that in some of the North Carolina farms, and it'll start to become more, it'll start to be pushed further out. And so here is what really benefiting from vertical integration. And the real idea is its unparalleled level of traceability and food safety. So we have the hog production where the hogs are raised, and it goes all the way to the processor, all the way to where they're eaten. And you can track that meat all the way through, which is really important. And so what is SPG? So SPG would then just be the genetic supplier to Smithfield. And so it manages the breeding pyramid to maximize genetic improvement in the commercial sow and the market animal. So Smithfield Premium Genetics would be up here, and you have your nucleus and then all of your multipliers. And then we make sure that all 1 million sows have enough semen and they're filled to full capacity, and that's where you get that 22.6 million market animals. And so obviously there's a difference between 22.6 and how many we process. So Smithfield does buy some pork in order to meet that demand. And so it's really just about trying to make it so it doesn't get into an uncontrolled burn. We just try to manage stuff so it doesn't get too crazy. And this would be our genetic program. And the first presentation talked about crossbreeding programs, so we're all fully aware of why we do this and what happens here. And so this would be your typical, it's not really Smithfield specific, this would be your typical really swine breeding kind of genetic program that you see across the majority of companies, where you have your two maternal lines where you have Landrace and Large White. And I'll spare you guys of actually calling them by their numbers. I'll call them by their actual breed names. And we mate these two, a Landrace male to a Large White female, to produce our commercial F1 sow. So if you were to go out to a farm right now, this is what you would see, where it'd be a crossbred commercial F1 sow that has 100% maternal heterosis, right? And so then this gets mated, the commercial tow, to our Duroc animal. And then now that terminal market pig has 100% individual heterosis too. So that way we have maternal and the direct heterosis being captured where they need to be. And so the real question is, well, we have this sort of breeding structure where we have the maternal lines and the terminal line, and we know and we stock the commercial farms with F1 sows, and then we have these terminal market pigs. So how can we capture this data? And it's going back to our breeding goal of we're trying to maximize performance of the commercial sow and the commercial market pig. And we all know what a commercial test herd is. This would be an example of a beef one, where you have this bull, you mate it to a bunch of females, and then you look at their associated progeny. And you look at, on the terminal side, you would look at finishing and then slaughter. And on the maternal side, it'd be survival and sort of growth and their litter-bearing types traits. And so we do that on the for the commercial market pig. So what we do is, what's another a caveat to this, is in a normal setting, when you were to go to a commercial farm and look at a bag of semen, it'd be pooled across multiple sires. And so you wouldn't really do single sire mating, is not a common thing. And so what we do is we single sire mate Durocs to commercial farms in Missouri and North Carolina. And that way they can trace back all the way to their Duroc nucleus. And it's roughly around 60,000 carcass data points that are captured per year. And so this would be the trend from 2005 to 2019. And so you can see we've been doing this for quite some time, and this is not something that's new. It's been done for many, many years. And so some of the things that we capture would be sort of growth and carcass measures, and then also quality, and then loin and loin quality. And the key point here is that these are not specialized farms that they're sent to. They're just regular commercial farms, so they have diseases. They have all things that happen in a commercial setting, such as the stocking density may be a little higher, maybe a little low. So everything that happens at these farms is not regulated by us, so it's in a commercial farm. And this is really where we try to select animals that perform in an environment where they're supposed to perform, not in a nucleus environment that doesn't have any disease and maybe isn't the best situation. It is the best situation, sorry. And then when you get to the commercial farms, you kind of throw them to the wolves in a sense. And so this would be for the commercial market pig, but you can think of the same thing for the commercial sow, right? You have your F1 sow. And so this is we started this in 2012, and we're just now starting to be able to utilize the data, but it's around 800 gilts entered each month, and in the future it'll go to 1,500. And so what the trait that we look at here would be litter bearing. And also, when you think about in a nucleus, the turnover is really high. So if you want to try to understand or get a genetic parameter for stayability, it's really not possible in a nucleus setting in swine. And so this is really where this starts to pay off, is where we can really understand how long do these commercial F1 sows stay in the herd and capture that. And what's really interesting to see is that we have one of these farms where it traces, it's a commercial test, a commercial market pig test herd too. So the whole pyramid goes back to, the whole structure goes back to Nucleus Farms in terms of matings. And so these two, and these two commercial testers really drive what we do, and it really allows for us to select animals to maximize crossbred performance. And it's really harder to obtain if you don't have that commercial setting where you can send those animals and you know exactly what farm they're going to. And so, and what we do is all of the purebreds then are genotyped, and then once you have this sort of system where you have this commercial commercial data coming in, you can use genomic information on purebred animals prior to selection, and it significantly improves the ability to identify selection candidates that excel at the commercial level. And that's really what we're after here. And so you can utilize these purebred genotypes and get a good idea of, well, how are they going to perform at the commercial level? And it's really improved our overall system. So right now, there's, at the current time, we roughly over have 150,000. And this number seems small, but when you think about the population size, it's actually fairly sizable. And another point, important point to make is that now, since all of these Duroks are genotyped, we, if you wanted to figure it out, you can go into the store, grab a piece of meat, genotype it, and we can go all the way back to say which sire this was from. And so it does allow for some traceability there. And it's also important, since we buy product, right? There's some times where there, it doesn't happen a lot, but if there is a needle in the meat, we can determine whether it was a company farm or whether it was a non-company farm to really start to determine if it's our fault or someone else's fault. And so that's kind of an overview of Smithfield and kind of what SPG does, and what, and where I really think big data will come in is in terms of making it easier to collect those commercial phenotypes. So it does take quite a bit of work to do that, and I'll describe in the next few slides about kind of what happens and what kind of steps are involved in that. And so as I was saying before, like, what is big data? And it really depends on who you ask. But it has the following characteristics. It's volume, it's the quantity of data being generated, variety, it can come from a variety of sources like text, images, audio, and video, and velocity is the speed at which it's generated, and then the veracity is that the data quality can vary greatly. And I'll show you some slides that kind of depict this, and it makes you really, it'll make you realize that you really do need to have a sophisticated system just to manage this type of data. Because when it goes south, it can go south really quickly. And so you want to make sure you know what happened there. And this is what I was saying before. At some point in time, data generating platforms was considered big, but as technology improves, it's kind of no longer considered big. And kind of what I'll be going through today is kind of what I determine as big data, where it's generated from high-throughput data recording and phenotyping platforms based on pictures, sensors, and sound data. And the key point is that there's minimal human involvement when you collect the data, but then when you have to go and utilize the data, that's where the human involvement, you have to generate some analytical methods to understand what the data is telling you. And really, you can start to collect data that would otherwise not be possible when done at scale. And this is what I was talking about in the packing plant, when you try to collect lots of observations, not just maybe a single time point, and then utilize that. And so some of the examples that are currently being utilized or that we have used would be feed intake recording systems, which is what you guys have a good understanding of, and then port quality at line speed, weather stations, and then I'll talk about the water jet pork belly trimmer. And this would be an example of the fire station. And so electronic feeder systems have been around since the 90s in pigs, and what it does is it utilizes the RFIDs. And so this would be where the feed is, and then this would be where an animal will come in. And it uses the RFID, and it says, this animal is here, and it says, well, how much did it eat and how much did it weigh? And that's kind of the basic assumption of these fire feeders. And it's traditionally been utilized as a selection tool to improve the genetics of feed efficiency, but obviously you can get a lot of other metrics. You can get some feeding behavior, and I'll go over some slides that depict kind of the feeding behavior of these different animals. And one of the key points is that's traditionally placed in a high-health nucleus setting and recorded on purebreds, because these things are actually pretty expensive, and so you want to make sure that the data you do collect is quality data and the animals that you collect them on is important. And so SPG first started to use them in the early 2000s, and so we roughly have around 64 stations, and we have 12 pigs per station. So that, and on average, a pig has around 7 visits per day, and so that's 670 visits for the poll period, which is around 90 days-ish, around there. And so when you think about how much each station generates, it's around 8,000 visits in a single turn, and you have 4 turns in a year. And so when you start to do all this math, you get roughly 2 million animal observations per year. And this is kind of what comes in with these stations when they're fully going. And so at some point in time, it looks like this. And this is where if the data is bad, it just keeps on coming in. And at some point in time, you want to say, hold on. But it doesn't do that. It just keeps on flowing in. And so the next few graphs is what I'll kind of show you of what type of data is collected. So this would be for a station for a full group on the 90 days. So on the y-axis, you have the variable, so daily feed intake in pounds, or how long they were at the feeder, daily occupation time in minutes. And so you can see here it roughly increases and it gets to around that value. And each line would then be a pig. And so you can see the variability across time, and also you kind of see a trend for a given station. And then you see the daily occupation time also. And in a few minutes, I'll tell you, well, what happened here? And these are kind of, these would probably be your traditional means of what these fire feeders are for, right? Where they track, well, how much did this pig eat? And then they get their weight, and then that's where you really can start to look at feed efficiency. And probably less so, you can see how the behavior data can also be utilized. And this would be the daily mean feed intake per visit. So how much did they eat when they went into the machine for each visit? And so you can kind of see it increases. And then daily occupation time per visit, and this is kind of decreases across time. And again, you can see the variability across animals. And then the daily feeding rate per visit, and this would be the feeding rate per visit, and this is pounds per minute. And these would all be observations that you can get from these fire feeders and just for one station for a particular time point. And this would be for an animal where you can really start to see just the number of data points starts to really stack up. And so this is where I was saying, like, what happened here? And so at some point the station ran out of feed, right? And so there's stuff like this that happens where you're like, oh, shoot. And or like this where you'll see that this would be the weight for a particular pig, and it kind of just chugs along here, and all of a sudden in one day it gained roughly 75 pounds. Which is pretty cool, right? And then you'll see it drop down and you say, that wasn't real, right? And so there's stuff like this that you have to constantly look at the data. And we have platforms, or we have analytical methods that look at this where they say if a station's down, it'll alert the farm staff. Or if this happens, it'll automatically remove the data. And so what we use would be called robust regression, where if it in a sense, it looks to see if it's an outlier, and if it's an outlier based on a certain point, then it's deleted. So these would be all removed without any human intervention. And so really what we have used to track this, and the key point is to make sure that what we're seeing and what the farm staff is seeing are the same, and there's no confusion where they're like, I didn't see that, so, well, I did. And so there's lots of differences here. And this has actually been really important for us in order for them to see it and us to see it. It would be a dashboard or a Shiny app where you can log on and see, well, how many stations are currently down where they have no feed intake or no observations, or how many animals are currently have issues. And so they can go into the pen and they can see this. And this is one of the interesting points with big data is you have to do these types of methods or else the data just becomes hard to manage and it's really difficult to give to the farm staff and say there's an issue here, this is why, in a timely manner. And so it's been really helpful in limiting the number of times that this happens or how many days they go. And also here where this was just a scale calibration issue that they just had to go out and fix and it takes a few seconds. And it does provide an effective way to monitor data quality and fix any issues as they arise. And so it's really important to have these type of things when you start to do these big data type effects, is then you can really understand what's happening, and it provides a good good feedback from the farmers. And also, if the farmers are seeing something that we're not, then it provides a good feedback. Maybe we're missing something. And this would be so the fire feeders, and then what's been a little bit more recent would be line speed packing plant phenotyping. And so this would be through the commercial test herd program, where those carcasses can be traced back to a single sire. And you can see there's the fatometo port quality at line speed, where it goes into the meat and looks at back fat thickness and loin depth. And here's one that's really, really interesting, is the belly would go under, and then it uses a water jet, and it cuts the belly so it's in the right shape. And it tracks the belly weight for the trimmed and untrimmed, the thickness, the width and length, and the fat ratio. And this would be all at line speed. And I wish I had a video of this, but I couldn't get one in time. But it basically just uses a water jet and cuts the belly, and it keeps track of all this information. So this all feeds back in terms of the fatometer, and this all feeds back when we try to look at these Duroc's, the sires, and see, well, which ones should we select based on this information. Now we'll start to get into the recent developments. And I just kind of combed the literature and just kind of looked at, well, what's been going on in the past few years, and it wouldn't be mainstream yet in terms of our swine genetic companies using them, but you can kind of see where it's heading and what type of uses there are. And if you went to Dr. Bruce Golden's talk yesterday, in a sense it uses the same thing, where it uses these deep neural networks and images is where this type of thing really shines in terms of trying to generate these phenotypes. And so the first one, I did not think of the name. The authors called it as tailception, where it uses carcasses to see if there are missing tails or tail biting, to determine if there are certain animals that have their tail bitten or others that don't. And this would be the scales here. So 0 would be a full-length tail, and here would be one that's been completely bitten. And then they have tail loss, where there's a full tail and then a tail loss. And so they, at line speed, they would look at this and take a picture of the carcass, and then they would go back and then try to classify these images, either they have their tail bitten, and then in terms of what level it's bitten by. And you can see this picture. This would be the image, and this would be what part of the image has greater influence on whether it's classified as a tail bitten one or whether it's classified as a not tail bitten one. And so you can see it's right where the tail's at, which is what you would hope that would happen. It's not looking at something else. And so you can see here it's where the tails are at in terms of whether they're bitten or not. And this would be, if you were to look at, so they had human observers that looked at, well, what's the actual label of this image, and then the predicted label. And you can see here when they classify them as 0 being a full tail or 4 or 3 being the partial or full loss, you can see, you can really guess if they're got a full tail, and you can really guess if there's been tail bitten, but in between it gets a little bit more difficult in terms of correctly classifying that. But when you look at a 0-1 scale, whether they have it or they don't, you can see the agreement's really high. So on average, the predicted and the true are 95% correct. And another a really interesting point is, so automated computer system to calculate body weight. And so in pigs, what would happen is you go into a finisher and you need to find the animals that are in this given weight range. And so the hardest is when you go in and the pen is full and you get bitten. So you don't want to stay in the pen that long, right? And so you try to identify those animals that are in that range. And sometimes it gets a little bit difficult. And that's where it's this idea of, well, can we put a camera above the pen to try to generate the weight for that given animal. And so it uses this type of machine camera, the Kinect V2 sensor, and it uses like volume, length, heights, and the roundness of the animal, and the mean absolute error is right a little under 10 pounds in terms of if they were to weigh the animal, or they were to use this image to try to predict what the animal would weigh, is roughly 10 pounds. And so it's pretty good, but it's still needs to be lower. And a lot of these companies, I think, are waiting until it gets to the below the point where they can see it's an economic benefit to have this. Because if you think about in Smithfield where they have so many finishers, if they were to do this on a large scale, it has to be a fairly big investment in order to make that. But it has great potential to minimize sort loss. And so you can generate prediction algorithms based on kind of start weights and the stocking density of these animals. And you can kind of get within 10 pounds over on average where these animals will be. But the hardest part is reducing your variance in your loads. So this is really where there's great opportunities to do that. And another part is, which seems kind of like in a sci-fi movie, would be facial recognition for animal identification in pigs. So what they did here is this would be the water. And so an animal would go and get a drink of water, and the camera would be right behind it. And they would take a picture of that pig, and this is what the pigs look like. And so you can see some have the colors are pretty unique. And other ones like 2 and 3 and 6, if you were to look at them, they'd be like, that's the same pig, right? And so what they did is they used these pictures to try to classify which animal was which animal. And you can see here, this would be, if you go back, there was 10 animals. And so the true label would be the ID for each animal. And this would be their predicted ID. And you can see here that when you start to get into these animals that have unique color markings on their face, they're pretty easy to predict. Or on average, you'll be right 100% of the time. But the animals like 2 and 3, you can see, well, there are some issues here. And so there's still a little bit of ways to go, but I think this does describe how you can really maybe potentially use this facial recognition and not have to tag every single animal. But the real issue is what happens when animals get older, right? So animals age a lot quicker than humans, so there's some more issues related to can you use this same image for an animal that's 6 weeks older? So there's some of that going on. And this would be the same type of graph. So this would be the image, and this would be, when it looks at it, what part of the image is it looking to make that classification? So it's using this and this to classify this as being animal 1 or the snout to be animal 2. And you can kind of see when you look at these color animals, you can see black nose is right here. And so you can see where it picks up on those color uniqueness for the face. And another point would be the automated livestock monitoring. And the previous presenter kind of touched a little bit on this. At the University of Nebraska, they put these overhead cameras in, and they use it to capture behavior of the animal to see, well, is this normal, is this not, and how much drinking time have they had. And so this would be the input image, and they actually look for its two ears, and then its shoulder, and then its butt, and they use that to figure out to position the animals, and they associate the body parts to identify the whole animals. So here would be the body parts, and then this would be the part of the whole animal. And so you can see here that this is, when they look at the input image, they draw the lines, and you can figure out which animals are where. And it's actually really exciting to see that in the training set, they had roughly 20,000 images. And so the accuracy is right around the recall and precision, which is a measure of accuracy, pretty good above 0.9. And the key point is once you get into unseen images right here, where maybe they're darker and the lighting is not as good, that's where you see it fall out. But I think there's still a lot of potential in here of just monitoring these animals and figuring out the daily activity. And the other one that has been on the horizon is, so when you think about the fire feeders, usually they're in a disease-free setting. And so when you look at the feed intake across time, it's usually not because they're sick why they're dropping in feed. And so what you can do is put these fire feeders in a challenge barn, and you can look at daily feed intake and daily feed duration, and you can just look and see how much it changes to be able to select for animals that are more resilient to these challenges. So you can see animals that don't have a lot of fluctuations then would be more resilient to environmental challenges compared to animals that are up and down, like right here. And in kind of closing, so innovative technology will continue to be developed that collects data that would otherwise not be possible on a large scale. And some of these would be animal identification, weights, behavior, animal monitoring, and then all of these would produce these novel phenotypes. And the important point to make is I think it needs to prove it is useful to genetics as a selection tool and profitability of a swine production system. And this would be kind of in an integrated system is where you can really see this take off when it benefits both parties and you can really start to see the results here. And this is where we'll finish it off with kind of the future of big data. And this is again my own opinion, so it's not anyone else's. And so the big data will make it easier to collect relevant phenotypes at the commercial level. And so we, as a company, it does take a lot of effort to generate these commercial phenotypes and track these animals, but obviously it's important, and it'll increase the genetic improvement at the commercial level. And again, integrated companies will see the benefit of big data across sectors because that can be fully captured across the whole system and not end maybe just at genetics. It'll be carried through to all the way to the commercial setting. So it'll increase production at a lower cost, optimal live animal marketing, and then increase carcass uniformity and quality. And the key, and I don't really talk about genomics that much because I'm sure you guys have gotten full on with genomics, but it's important to realize that these purebreds all have genomics, and that's really not going to change in the future. And in essence, we'll start to genotype more animals. And what's important is that we generate these phenotypes that we can use and leverage these genotypes that are already being collected. And then we can use these purebred data in predicting this crossbred performance. And since it's already available, then the phenotyping issues then become the main driver in this improvement. And so this is kind of a general description of how we obtain carcass data now. So once a pig is born, they obtain ID on their both ears, and it's a linear barcode. And so this is what we use to tag animals. And so if you've ever been to the Walmart, the Walmart checkout line where you can use the little scanners, it's the same basic idea where all these pig farms now have Walmart scanners where they can go and they can tag these pigs and it'll come back as what where they came from and all in their ID. And so what happens is as they grow and they get to the packing plant, a human scans the tag as it moves across the line, and then that's how you can figure out which animal it is in the carcass plant. And the kicker is once you lose both those tags, then that animal becomes no longer a data point. And then you have to manually place two pegs in every pig. And so there are some issues with this, but obviously we've been doing it for many, many years, so it's down to a science where we're fairly confident in the stuff that we do get from this. And this is kind of the question that I pose with the big data is that, well, why we have this whole commercial system, why can't we use the whole system as a commercial market pig test? And it's really the human aspect of scheduling birth to packing plant and scanning those pigs as they cross the line. And it's really you don't want to slow down the packing plant. And at the current time, that doesn't happen. But the idea is you want to be able to collect data without any drop in speed in the packing plant. And it's this idea, do we really want to tag 22.6 million pigs a year and follow those all the way through? So the answer to that one is probably a no. And it's also the ability to track primal cuts for an animal after tag is removed without causing primal cuts to be taken off the line. So outside of the bellies, we have to take the loins off of the line and then put them back on the line in order to get phenotypic measures such as weight of the loin and all of that stuff, and of each primal. So it does become an issue outside of the bellies, where we're still more not in the, it's not automated quite yet. And it's really at the farm also to obtain feed intake, growth, and behavior at the individual animal level. And another important to make is, well, in the commercial sow test herd, do we really want to tag 1 million gilts each year? It's the same basic idea. And it's really the ability to track relevant phenotypes at the commercial level is difficult. And so you need to track individual piglets from birth to sow. So in a lot of these commercial farms, they would try to even up the number of piglets across litters. And so some of these pigs would be moved. And so when you get to tracking a piglet to a particular sow, it becomes really difficult because these pigs are sometimes going all over the place. And so there's no good way of tracking a lot of that stuff. And I really think there's you can look at more effective phenotypes for mothering ability rather than just the outcome of number weaned. And so that's a lot more difficult when pigs are moving. So it'd be you can use a lot of this big data to hopefully generate new phenotypes that are more closer to the actual economical trait. And so the PACU plant continues to adopt innovative technology that is able to collect phenotypes at line speed. And so it's really this, the PACU plant will continually to add these into their system. And the main driver behind all of this is the tagging of the individual pigs and carcasses. That's the main hang-up. And it's without the use of tags. So how far out would we be with facial recognition? It's probably many years, but it's this idea that once we start to be able to identify pigs at line speed and then take their carcasses, take their primals out, then it becomes really interesting where you can really start to collect this data at a very, very big scale. Because really the only hang-up now would be trying to ID these animals and keep that consistent. And then in the farrowing and growth phase, and I think it really allows for a better understanding of the relationship between traditional phenotypes such as average daily gain, piglets wean, and behavior or daily activity. And what I'll kind of give an example of this is when you look at the highest value of any given high-throughput recording platform is not just through one particular platform. It's when you start to combine these and you start to stack them together, and that's where you really start to see a lot of the value. And so you can see here that on average a pig eats roughly 70 minutes during the day, and the other question is, well, what is it doing the other 95% of the day? And so is a pig like this where it kind of just hangs out and eats, or is a pig like that where it goes crazy? And you can start to see where maybe some of these pigs and how they behave impact their production. And so we don't really know it at this point at a large scale of what's going on here. And again, feed intake data only represents 5% of a pig activity. And it's also how does an animal respond to environmental stressors like disease, environmental stress, transportation. And again, it's how active is an animal when it's not eating. And a lot of these questions we don't have a good handle on in terms of how this impacts the production. And so hopefully we don't have pigs like this. And kind of just final comments. And I think it's a really excited time for to be in an integrated company because you can really start to see the benefits of big data coming through at the commercial level. And it really is, can we trace these animals back to the nucleus and can we start to better understand of what these more potentially relevant phenotypes are and phenotypes that we never had the opportunity to get at such a big scale like behavior, where you can maybe get behavior for a small study, but in terms of routinely measuring it, that becomes a lot more possible. And I think there's a lot more technology in terms of using these apps to be able to better talk to the farmer and better portray the data where they can play with it and fully understand what's happening. And then this point here where it has to be useful to genetics and to the commercial production, I think these two will start to really converge where it's useful to both of us, and therefore we're really going to try to incorporate this into our production setting. When if you're not an integrated business, maybe it's useful at the very end, but as a geneticist, it's really hard to get that information. But when you start to become integrated, you can start to work together to really understand how to collect these phenotypes and the best way to get those. And these would be some of the sort of metrics that I would see in the future where it really starts to pay off. And with that, I am done, so...